Hi, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual health, hormonal health, and genitourinary health. And I have Dr. Helen Burney here with me today. And we are at the American Urological Association meeting in Las Vegas. Whoop, whoop, raise the Dr. Burney, can you please give the audience a brief introduction?
Yes, thank you so much for having me and talking with me today. So my name is Helen Burney. I'm a urologist and the director of male sexual and reproductive medicine at Indiana University. And I'm also the andrology fellowship director there.
So Dr. Burney is crushing it. She and her team are presenting 10, folks, 10 abstracts at the AUA this year. So, I mean, that is revolutionary. I don't know of anyone else who's presenting 10 pieces of work at the meeting. How does that happen? Like, when do you start preparing this work for the meeting? And what does your research team look like?
No, great question. So I think this is really a year-long process, right? As we're in clinic, as we're seeing patients, we have ideas. My fellow has ideas. We have a clinical research fellow. I have two wonderful APPs. And then we have some medical students that also are very interested in urology that join our team. Indiana University has a really wonderful program called the IMPRESS program, which is for medical students interested in research and presentation skill building. And so every summer, there's a 10-week period from May and July that you get different medical students that are dedicated time to do research as well. And we've been very fortunate to have several that have been really driven and really motivated that have really helped us create data and build our databases. And so I think, you know, once you start building some databases, then you have everything to kind of keep continuing to pull from, and you prospectively maintain those. It's definitely not a one-person job. I mean, I couldn't do any of this without the absolutely amazing research team that I have, which is our clinical research fellow, Lucas Amorim, our past fellow, Tyro Pereira, who is heading off to the University of Rochester next year. Super excited for him. And then Jacob Rust, my current fellow. And we really just worked really hard. We meet monthly for a research meeting where we really hash out ideas and we talk about status of where we are. And then if anyone has new ideas, they're like, hey, you know, I was thinking of this the other day. We kind of put it on a little spreadsheet and we just kind of tackle them as we go. So been very lucky, very fortunate to have that. And then, of course, you know, you get really lucky with so many wonderful colleagues like yourself in urology that you get to do multi-institutional studies with and you get to collaborate with. And so I really just think that's one of the wonderful things about urology.
Well, I love that. So it really takes a year. I know all of us, when we see the deadline for the abstract, we're like, it's crunch time. I'm going to write up this abstract and I have 16 hours until the due date. But really, and sometimes, yeah, I mean, oftentimes we're kind of waiting until the last minute to maybe write it up. But the real work in terms of doing the actual research, the planning starts at least a year before.
Oh, yeah. And we're constantly, like for our penile implant database, every day in the OR after we're done with an IPP, it gets added to the database. And then at the 3-month mark, we're adding the SIPI survey validation. We're checking for any post-op complications that occurred in any of those patients. So we're prospectively maintaining them so that it's not this huge crunch, you know, like a month before we're, oh my God, we got to get through the chart and get all this stuff out. So it makes it manageable.
Yeah, I love that. So we're not going to go through all the different, you know, presentations that you're talking about at this meeting, but I do want to focus on a few of them, which I find really fascinating. And the first one is in the realm of men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer who are then put on testosterone therapy. And during my training at Baylor, I worked with Larry Lipschultz and Mo Kira. And, you know, I started doing that work looking at men who had all degrees of prostate cancer, including high risk. And then we retrospectively looked at whether or not they had an increased risk for biochemical recurrence. And I knew the research was important at the time. I don't think I understood how important it was at the time in terms of like practice changing. And so we continue to build on that work, right? Can you talk about the work that you're doing in that space?
Yeah. So like you, I trained in my fellowship under Don Mulhall, who is also a big proponent of testosterone and safety in prostate cancer. And so this was really something that started in fellowship, my interest and drive. When I started at Indiana University, I met with all of our urologic oncologists and I talked to them about how comfortable they were with me starting patients on testosterone therapy. And we have such an amazing group. Even one of our faculty, Dr. Clint Baylor, has an amazing R01 grant that's looking at PSMA scanning in patients with prostate cancer and then looking at their outcomes, both oncologic outcomes and quality of life, so incontinence and erectile function. So this has really been a big thing. But what we did was we looked at all retrospective review of our patients at Indiana University from 2013 to 2023 who had all undergone a radical prostatectomy. And we broke them up into two groups. So we have two different abstracts, one in your organ-confined prostate cancer, which is going to be your Gleason grade groups 1, 2, and 3, and then your non-organ-confined. So your Gleason grade groups 4, 5 are, again, non-organ-confined, so positive nodes, things like that. And what we did was we stratified them into patients that had normal testosterone that we did nothing with. Patients
and really quick, how are you defining normal testosterone?
Yes, good question. So normal testosterone is defined per the AUA guidelines of less than 300 nanograms per deciliter drawn in the morning, early morning with two labs.
Okay.
So if they have low testosterone, 300 or less, then these patients were stratified into different groups. And several of them, again, this was retrospective, so several of them had been given testosterone therapy during our time. And we looked at the ones that were normal testosterone, untreated, low testosterone that we did not treat, low testosterone that we treated, as well as some with normal testosterone that we treated. Because typically in my own practice, if I have a patient that has a total testosterone level of less than 450 that's symptomatic, I'll give them a trial of testosterone because we don't know where their testosterone level was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so if it's 450 early morning, you know, by the middle of the day, they're probably close to being hypogonadal or under 300.
And we see enough of those patients in follow-up to know a lot of them do well.
Yes, yes. So we looked at all these, right? And we followed them for a median time of over 50 months. And we looked at biochemical recurrence rates. And actually in both groups, not just the organ confined, but in the high-risk prostate cancer, you know, your non-organ confined prostate cancer group, we still found that the group that was the low T, not treated, had the highest rates of and shortest time to biochemical recurrence. So again, I just think this shows that testosterone therapy is safe in select patients, and it doesn't increase time of or rates of biochemical recurrence in men with prostate cancer.
Wow, that's fascinating. So in terms of your own clinical practice, and in this conversation right now that we'll delve into, this is going to be off guidelines. I just want to kind of pick your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's say you have a guy who's seeing you who has low testosterone, and you put him on testosterone therapy, and then you see an abnormal increase in his PSA. So then he goes down, you know, the elevated PSA rabbit hole, right?
Right.
And gets diagnosed with, let's say, intermediate risk prostate cancer. And has his surgery, his radical prostatectomy, let's say scheduled 2 months in the future.
Gotcha.
What are you doing in terms of his testosterone therapy from that point until he's treated? And like from the time that he has his treatment to, let's say, his first PSA 3 months later?
No, great question. So a lot of it's very dependent on the urologic oncologist that I work with in our practice. But many of them, we leave these patients on testosterone and we leave them on testosterone. We treat them with prostate cancer and then we follow up their PSA 3 months later. And the reason for that is that we know that PSA is an androgen dependent process. So if you have a very low testosterone, you may have a falsely low PSA. So we believe that keeping their testosterone levels normalized is actually going to help us know that our PSA levels are accurate and both following and screening men for prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's such an interesting discussion because I see so many patients that are taken off their testosterone as they're going through the workup with the biopsies and then waiting for the treatment. And they feel very unwell during that process. Yeah. Maybe, do you think that's the next thing that we need to tackle? Right? Because I think now a lot of urologists understand that testosterone therapy is safe in men who have a history of prostate cancer that's treated. But I think we really now have to tackle the, I'm in the period, I'm waiting for treatment. How should I manage my testosterone? I don't know how we would necessarily study that and just kind of study it like we are right now, right? And looking at biochemical recurrence and things like that. But I think maybe that's the next question we need to answer.
Yeah. And you know, honestly, I hope and think in the future that hopefully the guidelines are going to change.
Yeah.
That every time you check a PSA, you should be checking a testosterone level as well. And the reason for that is, again, to make sure that your PSA is accurate so that we're actually following these guys correctly, right? And we're catching things when we should. So, you know, PSA in itself is in a predictor, right? Or low testosterone, I should say, is an independent predictor of higher grade and higher stage prostate cancer. And there's data on that. So why are we not looking at these both together? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very lucky at Indiana University. I have a lot of urologic oncologists who are fantastic in our department. And many of them check testosterone with PSA now all the time. So we're really following these patients as closely as possible.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I think your other like big message here is you got to have the conversation with the urologic oncologist.
Yes, yes.
And you had that early when you started at Indiana, just to sit down and kind of just say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think about that?
Absolutely.
And then you know from the get-go.
Absolutely. And same with your radiation oncologist, right? We're going to share a lot of patients that have radiation therapy for prostate cancer. And I think, again, the whole biggest point is it is a shared decision-making. You're talking with the patient. You're telling them the data on it. You're telling them what the AUA guidelines say, right? That there's an absence of long-term data and safety of prostate cancer and testosterone therapy. But I tell them the literature and I say, if you look in the publications now, there's no data showing that in someone with prostate cancer that we give testosterone therapy to, that they have higher rates of or shorter time to biochemical recurrence than men that we're not treating. In fact, it's the opposite all around, even in the data that you published with Mokara and Larry Lipschultz. So I just think, again, this needs to be the conversation and it's shared between yourself, the patient, they're either radiation oncologist or the urologic oncologist, and everyone's on board and feels good about it.
Yeah. I recently had a patient who was diagnosed with prostate cancer, had his surgery shared decision making, me, the urologic oncologist, the patient, we kept him on testosterone. That guy felt so good going into surgery. He was like working out. He was prepping like at the gym for surgery. You know, the other interesting thing, I think, just like in post-op recovery is oftentimes we tell patients, don't do, you know, like heavy physical strenuous activity for 3 months after surgery. This guy was super concerned because he had built his muscle. He felt amazing. He was concerned he wasn't going to be able to hit the gym for 3 months. That's also where I spoke with a urologic oncologist and I was like, does he really need to wait 3 months? And then he was like, no, that actually we don't, he doesn't need to wait 3 months. And I think he started back at the gym, like maybe like 4 weeks later and maybe did some like lower body stuff that's like less strenuous on the abdomen. So I think we have a lot in terms of like, okay, once they're recovering, how do we get them back to their daily activities? This guy feels so well.
They're our happiest patients, right?
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to the next topic here, which is the use of clomiphene in patients and looking at their lipid profiles. And I've recently had some discussions with Dr. Larry Lipschultz and Dr. Alex Tatum just on the notion of lipid profiles in men who are on testosterone therapy, because they routinely check lipid profiles. And that's not in the guidelines, looking at lipid profiles. And so I was recently sitting down with Dr. Lipschultz. I asked him, at what levels of like testosterone therapy would you put someone on where you would be concerned about changes lowering their HDL, raising their LDL? And he thinks like at pretty low level. So now I've been checking more lipid panels. So you're looking at lipid panels in the setting of clomiphene. What did you all find?
No, great question. Yeah. So we actually check lipid levels in almost any guy. If I'm checking his testosterone levels, they're coming to us. We're a men's health center.
Yeah.
And I think as urologists, we really are the gatekeepers of urology. Doesn't mean that you have to treat every primary care disorder, but men don't go to the doctor, right? On general, men die 7 years earlier than women in general in the U.S. So they're coming to see a urologist for very strong reasons. They can't pee, they can't get an erection, or they're having trouble trying to conceive, right? Those are really strong motivators. They get a guy in the door and they have, most all of them have symptoms and they have risk factors that are related to erectile dysfunction or whatnot. And so you're checking a testosterone level. So I get a lipid panel as well, right? I'm checking if they have obstructive sleep apnea. I'm asking all those questions. I'm looking at their hemoglobin A1C levels because that's where you can now bring them in, right? And you have a lot of motivation because sex and erectile function or infertility as well as not being able to pee are really strong motivators for talking to men about improving their health. So I get them
really quick. Are you getting like the standard lipid panel? Or are you getting advanced lipid panels?
No, great question. So I get a standard lipid panel, which is triglycerides, cholesterol, LDLs, HDLs, the ratio of that, hemoglobin A1C levels, as well as the true hormonal panel. So it's everything, your total testosterone, free testosterone, LH, FSH, estradiol, prolactin. I'm checking it all, sex hormone binding globulin. So we're looking at all these things because it gives me a lot of information. I can talk to these guys. You know, in another study that we presented last year, we found in young guys even coming to my office, like 45 and under for infertility, over a third of them had two or more cardiovascular risk factors that were undiagnosed, right? So if they hadn't come to see me for fertility. So this is kind of where that idea stemmed from. And we prescribe Clomid for a lot of men. You know, it's used off-label. It's a selective estrogen receptor modulator. We prescribe it a lot of times off-label for testosterone in men. And I had a patient of mine that ended up in the ER for pancreatitis. And I previously had not been checking lipid panels. This was a young 27-year-old guy, and his triglycerides were through the roof.
Wow.
And this was someone who had already had elevated triglycerides. I didn't know it. I put him on Clomid, and then it put him into pancreatitis. So then I was like, you know what? We're going to check triglycerides in everyone. We're going to check it on, right? That
all it takes sometimes is one patient.
So we started checking in everyone, and this is where it was amazing. I started finding so many men that had elevated triglycerides. So when we went into the study, I thought it was going to give us our hypothesis was that we were going to find that just like in the case studies with women, it increases triglycerides and that, you know, you should probably have a set level that, you know, you won't prescribe Clomid to unless they get under this level of triglycerides. And so when we did it, surprisingly, and this may be a little bit because now when I see elevated triglycerides, I'm like, go see your primary care doctor first. We can't prescribe you Clomid, you know. But now what we actually saw was HDL levels lowered. And, you know, that's our good cholesterol. So the idea is that we put men on Clomid sometimes indefinitely, including men that aren't interested in fertility because it's an easy way that you think, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or every other day to take an oral medication and naturally raise your testosterone levels. And so what is the meaning? What is the significance of this? If it statistically lowers HDL, and our lab values were just drawn the 4 weeks after they initiated Clomid, because that's when I get initial labs in patients so that we can dose adjust and make sure everything is safe. We need to follow them longer term. And that's really, you know, the biggest limitation of our study is looking at it long term of, are these going to continue to lower? Is this going to further lower? Because that's protective, right? And we don't want to do something indefinitely that is potentially going to harm patients.
Well, especially because oftentimes the patients that we put on Clomid are younger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. So on the topic of oral therapies, now I want to delve into the oral testosterone space. And so you were involved in a study looking at different dosing profiles of oral testosterone. And what did you find in that work?
So this was a really nice, it was a phase 3 randomized controlled trial of Jatenzo. And this was a study looking kind of post hoc of an up titration. So the recommended starting dose of oral testosterone in Jatenzo is like 237, and you take it twice a day. And they looked at what percentage of patients were hypogonadal, and they based everything on the AUA guidelines. So looking at a mid-tier range of 450 to 600 of total testosterone levels. And they found that there's still a large percentage of guys that remained hypogonadal, even on this starting dose that's your FDA black box warning or FDA label of what to start patients on. And so we looked at this analysis, and we found that actually if you up-titrated it and you started patients on this dose, A, it kept testosterone levels in normal healthy range. It had a no increased worsening risk of polycythemia or adverse side effects. And so, you know, kind of the conclusion and my takeaway from this was, is that, you know, maybe even though the recommended starting range is this, maybe we should be starting patients actually at a higher dose, because then we're going to catch more patients at a normalized level of testosterone therapy. And then you have less of this back and forth with patients. Let's check your labs. Let's increase your dose. Let's see you back in 4 weeks, check your labs. Now let's re-increase your dose, which becomes very time intensive and labor tedious for looking at labs and follow-up with patients. Mm-hmm. And so I
just because you have to time the labs, like, you know, within a couple of hours of taking the medication, it requires a lot. Yeah.
So this is just kind of I hope that this abstract really just shows people that, you know, hey, this is a way that we can prescribe testosterone in a safe way that puts them in a normal testosterone level where you're not having to go back and forth with all this extra titration and up titration of patients.
So let me ask you about the logistics of that study. The testosterone levels were checked at very frequent time points. How does that actually happen?
So they actually checked the plasma level testosterone levels of all these patients that were in that trial. Now, for our study, we actually had them get the normal 24-hour level. Because in real-world practice, I'm not checking someone's testosterone every 4 hours.
Right.
We're not
checking
that. So we actually looked at the meaning of the 24-hour serum plasma.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. And I agree. Like, and I think this work is actually so important, even though it seems like a pretty simple conclusion. Because when you look at the American Urological Association guidelines for testosterone deficiency, I remember as a young person in practice, you look at the table of all the different formulations of testosterone, all the different dosing ranges, all the different frequency ranges. It's overwhelming. You don't know where to begin. So oftentimes it's easier just not to start.
Right.
And I think that it's really helpful for there to be research out there that says this is a place to start.
Yes.
And like you, with my oral testosterone patients, for the most part, I'm starting them at the highest dose because we know from that research that about 3/4 of them end up on the highest or second highest dose anyway, and it is a very safe medication. So I think this research, even though it's in its simplicity, is actually very helpful for practice management.
Yeah. Because a lot of people, you know, one of the reasons they're so against testosterone is they're having to check those labs.
Yeah.
They're having to follow up with those patients. And if you have a very busy clinical practice, you know, I'm really lucky that I have a fellow and a nurse practitioner and an RN who's just ours for the men's health program that checks things. But, you know, you're having to check your own labs. And if you're having to bring all these patients back every 4 weeks checking labs and then again changing their dosing, you know, it really gets time consuming. It gets intensive, labor intensive. And then you just don't want to deal with these patients. And I think that's really a disservice because I think it's something that's important and that we should take care of these patients. So again, I agree with you that I think the point of this study and my idea for it was that, you know, really how can we make things easier for patients and for providers that are prescribing testosterone therapy?
So, all right. So we're about a year out from our next AUA. So what research questions are you cooking up for next year?
To be determined. Follow along.
Thank you all for joining us today.